Well, before all that, before I was called to the bar in 1978, I was here 50 years ago this summer. Where has the time gone? I was preparing to do part one. I was a fairly idle undergraduate and spent a lot of time doing other things, going to parties and in bookshops. And once I was in a secondhand bookshop and I saw on the shelves an old copy of Wittgenstein's Structures. And I opened it, and in the fly leaf was the name F.R. Leavis. And I thought, well, I've got to buy this. I had no money on me, so I dashed back to my room in John's, came back, and the book had gone. And that's sort of reflection of how you miss things in life. So if you ever come across a book with somebody's famous initials in it, then or its signature, then please buy it. Of course, it could be that someone's going through all the secondhand bookshops in the country falsely putting names in. So you have to be careful about that. So that was one thing that happened to me in the 1970s. If you're putting it in history, that was just after we joined the UK, joined the EU, or EEC as it was in those days. We'd become one of the nine, originally six, we'd become one of the nine countries. And there'd been a referendum in 1975 whether we should stay in the EU, because in those days, the Tories, Conservatives were broadly speaking in favour of the EU, and there's a large chunk of the Labour Party that was against it. So Harold Wilson decided to have a referendum on it, which I voted on. The first time I think I voted in this country was in a referendum on the EU, which was to stay in, which was resoundingly won. And then in 1976, the other reflection I had on listening to Nabil when he was talking about how life is really a battle between the only options of discourse and violence. I was recalling the great poetry of the Sex Pistols, which exploded in 1976 with Anarchy in the UK. Anarchy in the UK, it's coming sometime, maybe. I know what I want, and I know how to get it. I want to destroy the passerby. So there's nothing particularly new in this, but challenge between discourse and violence. It's been with us, I would suggest, throughout history. Anyway, that's enough anecdotage from me. What am I here to talk about? Well, I'm here to talk about the judiciary, the rule of law in Europe. I've also added rather cheekily, and the UK, because I'm an English judge, and obviously that's my specialism, what happens in England. I know quite a bit of what happens in Europe, but I thought it'd be quite interesting to contrast how I see the judicial conceptions, or how the rule of law is applied or considered and addressed in the two spheres, Europe and the UK. Everyone in the room will, I hope, believe in the importance of the rule of law. I hope there aren't any anarchists here, although you're welcome if you are. But please don't start behaving in an anarchic way while I'm speaking. Well, what does the rule of law mean and why is it important? Well, as Nabil has pointed out, there's no consensus about that. Sir Geoffrey Voss, who's my boss, the master of the rolls in charge of the Court of Appeals, said in a recent speech to the Alliance of Lawyers at Risk that it's opaque. We generally know it's important, but what do we mean by it? And what does the law mean by it? Well, we have to start thinking about this for all sorts of reasons, not least because it's now become part of our written law. It was long regarded as a principle of our unwritten constitution. But in 2005, the Constitutional Reform Act introduced it expressly in these words, Section 1, this act does not adversely affect A, the existing constitutional principle of the rule of law, or B, the Lord Chancellor's existing constitutional role in relation to that principle. So, well, what does that mean? You go to the definition section. There's no definition section of what is meant by the rule of law. It's just there, an existing constitutional principle. The editors of the White Book, the Supreme Court Practice, which is the book which we judges go to as our court of call setting out the rules, say this about Section 1 of that Act. This provision excited considerable parliamentary debate. It was not at all clear whether all of those who participated either fully understood what they were talking about or were talking about the same thing. It is a curious provision, the editors say. The best that can be hoped is that it will prove to be harmless. Well, that's not much of an ambition, is it? An aspiration for the rule of law. But if MPs were unclear about what they were talking about, that's not entirely surprising, because as Nabil has alluded to, academics and judges have been arguing about it for many years. Every professor of law, probably every student of law sitting here, will have some idea, their own interpretation of what it means. But there have been lots of suggestions, broadly falling, as you all probably know, into two distinct concepts, or overlapping concepts, rather, the so-called formal concept and the substantive concept. The formal, or sometimes called the thin concept, is that the rule of law is about how the law is made and applied, and not about the content of the law. Although people ought to have substantive rights, they should be articulated separately on their own terms. The second concept is the substantive concept. In contrast, those proponents say that law is also about the substantive content of the law and embraces fundamental values such as human rights. If you're looking for where these come from, in broad, very broad terms, Fuller and Raz are proponents of the thin formal concept, and Dworkin and Paul Craig and other academics on the academic side are proponents of the substantive content. But the person most associated in this country with the thick substantive content is Lord Bingham, the former Lord Chief Justice and presiding judge in the House of Lords, in his book, The Rule of Law, in 2010. And he expressly include in his definition of the rule of law human rights and other substantive elements, including the right to a fair trial and also the principle of judicial independence. That is all wrapped up in the definition of the rule of law, so far as he is concerned. The formal concept proponents, the thin concept proponents, acknowledge the importance of those principles, but see them sitting as outside the rule of law, so that it's possible in that context, taken to its extremes, for a formal rule of law to apply, even in a totalitarian state. Indeed, Joseph Raz notoriously took this to extremes, observing once that the law may institute slavery without violating the rules, the rule of law. It's interesting to see how these two concepts have been applied and interpreted in Europe and the UK. And this is going to be a pretty simplistic analysis, and I'm sure Albertina will correct me and introduce the nuances later on this morning. But I think in very simplistic terms, it seems to me that the conception of the rule of law in Europe has evolved from the formal to the substantive. It's interesting to see Nabil demonstrate that the origins of a more substantive interpretation are perhaps discernible earlier in history. But it seems to me that's been the broad trend in Europe. So if we look at the key texts are the Charter, including in particular Article 47, the Charter of the EU, which includes in under Article 47 the right to an effective remedy and to a fair trial before an independent and impartial tribunal. And then the Lisbon Treaty, to which Nabil's referred already in Article 2. The Union is founded on the values of respect for human dignity, freedom, democracy, equality, the rule of law, and respect for human rights, including the rights of persons belonging to minorities. Now, the word values, which Nabil has focused very much on this morning, is there in the Lisbon Treaty. The previous iteration, as the Amsterdam Treaty, building on the Maastricht Treaty, referred not to values but to principles. And it could be argued, it seems to me, that this represents a shift from the formal concept to the substantive. Thirdly, in other respects, the Lisbon Treaty substantially strengthens compliance with the principle of the rule of law as part of the Union's constitutional framework. So, for example, in particular, Article 19.1 stipulates that that member states shall provide remedies sufficient to ensure effective legal protection in the fields covered by union law. Well, the CJEU has picked up the baton here and over a series of cases moved firmly toward, it seems to me, a substantive conception. It may well be this has been a trend for longer than I can discern, but for me, the turning point was the ASJP case, I won't attempt the Portuguese pronunciation, in 2018, in which the court held that to ensure effective judicial protection under Article 19.1 of the treaty, Lisbon Treaty, the maintenance of judicial independence was essential. And this trend has been demonstrated most dramatically over the last 10 years in the series of cases, in particular over the issues arising out of the politicization of constitutional courts in Central and Eastern Europe, series of cases, you will know, involving Poland and Hungary. So that in the latest, just look at the latest case from November last year, or December last year, the decision in Commission in Poland, in which the court found not only that the reforms instigated by the previous, not the current, the previous Polish government had violated EU law, but also that the Polish Constitutional Tribunal established by that government did not satisfy the requirements of an independent and impartial tribunal previously established by law because of the irregularities in the appointments for the procedures of the appointments of judges. And there are many statements in that judgment which seem to me to illustrate the court's clear adherence to a substantive concept. It follows paragraph 175 of the judgment. The court said, it follows from Article 2 that the European Union is founded on values such as the rule of law, which are common to member states in a society in which inter alia justice prevails. So that's the language of values, of substantive concept, with the rule of law seen in that context. 179, paragraph 179. A member state cannot therefore amend its legislation or indeed its case law in such a way as to bring about a reduction in the protection of the value of the rule of law, a value which is given concrete expression by inter alia Article 19. I'm emphasizing the word value. Obviously, they didn't do that, but I think that's designed. I'm doing that just to illustrate how the courts now sees the rule of law. And paragraph 180, whilst they have separate national identities inherent in their fundamental structures, political and constitutional, which the European Union respects, the member states adhere to a concept of the rule of law, which they share as a value common to their own constitutional traditions and which they have undertaken to respect at all times. Turning to the UK, by way of contrast, of course, UK lawyers have been heavily involved at various points in the last 70 years in the construction of the instruments, both within the EU and the Council of Europe. The European Convention on Human Rights, classically an example of a document drafted principally, or not principally, but certainly English law, UK lawyers are really heavily involved in that. Despite that, UK courts, seems to me, have historically adopted an interpretation of the rule of law that leans towards the formal concept. Now, there's probably a bit of work to be done. It's probably been done, not by me, to explore how that's changed over the 50 years of the UK's membership of the EU, 1973 to 2019. It's possible that in some respects, the UK courts have moved towards a more substantive model. And it may well be that some will see in the last 10 years since the referendum, particularly in the current Supreme Court, there's been a drift away from that model, and which may, of course, depending on political developments in this country, go considerably further. The UK Supreme Court certainly latterly has been more reticent, it seems to me, in recognising a substantive element in the rule of law. But one exception might be the case, the Rwandan case, AAA from 2023, in which the court held, Supreme Court held, that there were substantial grounds for believing that the removal of the claimants to Rwanda would expose them to a real risk of ill treatment by reason of refoulement. And at paragraph 26, Lord Reed and Lord Lloyd-George, given the judgment of the court, said, the principle of non-refoulement is given effect not only by ECHR, but also by other international conventions to which the UK is a party. It is a core principle of international law to which the UK government has repeatedly committed itself on the international stage, consistently with this country's reputation for developing and upholding the rule of law. So it seems to be in that judgment on this really important fundamental issue about the lawfulness of the refoulement of asylum seekers to Rwanda, the Supreme Court at that point touched upon the idea of the rule of law as a concept with substantive value. But such cases are relatively rare, at least so far as the judges are concerned, speaking judicially. But although they've been more reticent in that context, our senior judiciary have, in fact, been rather more expansive about discussing it extrajudicially. A lot of judges, much better qualified than I to speak about this, a lot of our senior judges have written and spoken about it. In addition to Lord Bingham and Sir Geoffrey Voss, to whom I've already referred, you'll find contributions from Sir John Laws and Sir Jack Beatson, both eminent academics and judges of the Court of Appeal, and most recently, Lord Sales, Philip Sales, who is currently the Vice President of the Supreme Court. Most strikingly, it seems to me, Lord Sales delivered a seminal speech in Wellington in New Zealand in 2024. What is the rule of law and why does it matter? And here he said this: what is often referred to as a formal conception of the rule of law has substantive and significant value in itself. It provides a minimum content for the rule of law, which should command our loyalty, even if one does not regard the concept as justifying or committing us to thicker versions of it involving a greater substantive set of principles. The more substantive the interpretation given to the concept, the greater the tension with the other foundational pillar of the Constitution, namely the democratic principle which underpins the sovereignty of Parliament in its modern instantiation. How that fundamental tension is resolved in any given polity depends on the political and legal culture of that polity. For Lord Sales, quotes, adherence to the rule of law in its formal version provides significant substantive benefits to the economic, political, and moral domains. He contends there is moral value inherent in a formal conception of the rule of law, quoting Professor Neil McCormack's observation that, quotes, among the values it can secure, none is more important than legal certainty, except perhaps its stablemates, security of legal expectations, and safety of the citizen from arbitrary interference by governments on their agents. Therefore, Lord Sale asks, if a formal conception of the rule of law already gives us these benefits, why should we adopt a more substantive one? He disagrees expressly with Lord Bingham's conception of the rule of law that includes the full range of human rights, but stresses that, quotes, to say that the concept of the rule of law does not involve human rights or democracy in no way diminishes the importance of these values. We live in a world in which we value pluralism, meaning that they are numerous and irreducible moral values. The rule of law, human rights, and democracy are each themselves basic values or clusters of values which cannot be reduced into one another, and we should not seek to unite them by searching for an overarching common metric. If we attempt to sidestep the conflict of values which occur within the rule of law idea and those which arise between the rule of law and other values by concealing them through the use of an expanded definition of the rule of law, we undermine our ability to engage in deliberation about how we should resolve these conflicts. The denial that there are such conflicts is associated with a form of elite managerial politics, which may be felt to be deeply frustrating for those who do not accept the consensus, and may serve to make political modes of accommodating the tensions more difficult. Contestation within a democratic framework is healthy rather than something to be avoided at all costs. So you can see how there are echoes in that of what Nabil was talking about language a few minutes ago. Well, this is quite a heady, arcane discourse, isn't it? And what does this mean in the real world, you may say? Well, what I'd like to do in conclusion is to look at how the rule of law is being affected in a number of contexts, in particular, a series of developments, three of particular importance. First of all, the rejection of the rules-based order. Secondly, attacks on judges and lawyers. And thirdly, the AI transformation. It seems to me that if we're thinking about what we mean by the rule of law, we have to consider how it is faring in the context of current developments, of which those three are particularly important. We can all see, can't we, that the notion that international affairs can be governed by universally accepted rules has been seriously challenged in the last few years, including by countries that hitherto have supported it. Stephen Miller, the White House Deputy Chief of Staff, said in an interview with the New York Times in January, "We live in a world, the real world, that is governed by strength, that is governed by force, that is governed by power." And although that view may have been most obviously pronounced in the White House, it has a much wider acceptance. Mark Carney, seen as perhaps the protagonist of that view in some respects, went so far as to say at Davos in his much-quoted speech, "Stop invoking rules-based international order as though it still functions as advertised. Call it what it is, a system of intensifying great power rivalry where the most powerful pursue their interests using economic integration as coercion." And he went so far as to quote Thucydides, "The strong do what they can and the weak suffer what they must." Alongside this, the second concern I have, the second development, is the greater incidence of attacks on lawyers and judges. This is happening across Europe, but I'm particularly aware of it, of course, in this jurisdiction. A friend of mine, a judge, a family judge sitting in Milton Keynes a couple of years ago, was attacked by a litigant who jumped over the bench, pursued him down the corridor, security not in attendance or not able to help, and started attacking him relentlessly until the assailant was eventually dragged off by his own girlfriend who had followed him into the corridor. That was a particularly egregious example, disgraceful example of an attack on a judge, but there are other examples. In addition to the physical attacks, there's a much greater incidence of verbal attacks. Now, there's nothing wrong with being criticized as a judge. One has to develop a thick skin to being criticized by academics. It's with some trepidation sometimes that I open a journal to see what academics have made of my judgments. I've never found one who... I've never had a judgment which is universally accepted by any academic. It's very good, isn't it? That's a good thing to be criticized. So that's fine. That's fine. But sometimes it goes further. So, for example, in last week's Sunday Times, I read this. "We allow activist judges, egged on by climate campaigners, to impose crippling restrictions on domestic energy exploration and production." The idea that activist judges, judges are actively taking a deliberately political line in applying the law, it is one which we have to face. It's an accusation which is made constantly. When appearing before the Commons Select Committee recently, the Lady Chief Justice was asked about the recent instance of political attacks on judges, individual judges, and said that if you choose to debate on a premise that is so false and sounds so remarkable that the judge's competence, bias, and integrity is called into question, that for me is a line in the sand. And she described this as a threat not only to the security of judges and the retention and recruitment of judges, all of which have been under strain, and public confidence in the justice system generally. She described it as, and she called this the first threat. The first is the threat to the rule of law and the democratic process. Because if things are being presented in a way that is inaccurate in Parliament and then in the media and beyond, politicians and members of the public are going to be making decisions on a completely flawed premise. And she described that as a fundamental threat to the rule of law and democratic process. The third development I want to mention, finally, is the most recent and perhaps the greatest. Technological advances, in particular the arrival of artificial intelligence, have opened the way to processes of decision-making that potentially obviate the need for human judgment altogether. These developments have been described and analysed academically in many quarters over the last 5 years, in particular in that racy journal, the Cambridge Law Journal, of which the most striking example is the article in 2022 by William Lucy from Durham, titled The Death of Law, Another Obituary, in which he predicted that traditional legal processes would be superseded by technological management, behavioural control by code, and would be destined for the dustbin of history. Well, as a judge nearer the dustbin at the end of my career than the beginning, that seems to me to be a thoroughly bad idea. AI plainly has enormous potential as a tool to assist the justice system, but the idea that it could completely replace human judgment is dangerous and repugnant. On the other hand, we have to face the facts. Several million disputes each year are resolved on eBay by a process involving code with no human intervention. Clearly, most people in this world are much more at home online in the world of tech and its processes and values than in the arcane world of the law. There are many more people sitting looking at screens at 10:05 on a Saturday morning than sitting in a lecture theatre listening to a judge talking about law. I'm involved in something called the Online Procedure Rule Committee, which is going to be responsible for making rules for digitised processes, including, we hope, the provision of legal information, advice, and dispute resolution. Last Friday, I attended a presentation of an AI tool called Hercules, which analyzes information and drafts an initial judgment, which can then be subject to judicial editing and review. Now, all these processes, developments, if managed and used properly, can greatly assist human judgment. But they won't replace human judgment, or they shouldn't. But the temptation for government will be not to stop there. Already governments across the world are hurriedly investigating the possibility of automated dispute resolution, as they are in other public sector provision, such as health. So they may end up agreeing with William Lucy when he said, quote, technical management is a brilliantly effective means of administering the lives of others, a particularly salient governmental technology, because increasingly easy to implement and effective across any domain dependent on IT. The rapid expansion of AI represents the greatest challenge to the rule of law, it seems to me. If adopted as a judgment writing process without any adequate regulation, it potentially threatens the rule of law in both its substantive and formal conceptions. Thank you. A judgment drafted by an algorithm using AI, provided by the government, is manifestly not either a fair trial before an independent and impartial tribunal, within the meaning of Article 47 of the Charter, nor does it provide the security of legal expectations and safety from the citizen from arbitrary interference by governments and their agents, required by the proponents of a formal interpretation. So finally, how should we proceed and respond to this? I suggest we focus on three steps, amongst many others. First, we need to agree what we mean by the rule of law. It's not enough to have a casual reference in the 2005 Act, which commentators describe as nothing more than harmless. If we have a constitutional principle of the rule of law in the UK, as well as in Europe, we need to articulate much more clearly what it means. Secondly, having agreed what we mean by it, we need to explain why it's so important. Changes in the educational curriculum and in news reporting, and above all, the rise of social media and its impact on reading habits and concentration, mean that many, perhaps most people, would find it impossible to comprehend the law and its ever-growing complexities. Their lives are governed by rules they don't understand. Lawyers have always spoken a different language from the rest of the population. That's no better now, and in many ways it's worse. How can we expect people to adhere to the principle of the rule of law if they don't understand what it means? Thirdly, if it is a constitutional principle, we have to make it more than hollow, meaningless verbiage. All conceptions of the rule of law, thick, thin, and everything in between, include the principle of accessibility. In this jurisdiction and many others, access to the courts for individual citizens face the twin hurdles, mountains perhaps, of cost and delay. The delays in particular are now a source of serious concern, as you all know. And at the heart of the rule of law, as Lord Reed said in the Unison case in 2017, is the concept, is the idea that society is governed by law. The rule of law is the society is governed by law. Courts exist to ensure that the laws made by Parliament and the common law created by the courts themselves are applied and enforced. In order for the courts to perform that role, people must, in principle, have unimpeded access to the courts. Without such access, laws are liable to become a dead letter. Now, when seeking to improve accessibility, of course we can channel modern technology far more effectively than we are at present. And so consequently, I do support the use of AI to that extent, as we all do. But although there may be scope for even some decisions to be taken by machine, in most cases, all decisions must be a matter for human judgment. I end as I begin with the observations of the Master of the Royal, Sir Geoffrey Voss, in his recent speech, when he said, "We should explain that as proponents of the rule of law, we are proponents of the clear and accessible predictability of the legal system, that we support open justice and access to fair justice for all, that we are seeking to protect the fundamental rights of all, and we support those states that exercise proportionate and accountable power over their citizens in good faith, and more than ever in the modern world, those states that comply with their obligations under national and international law." My conclusion is that, faced with the modern challenges I've described this morning, we're going to have to be ever more vigilant to uphold the rule of law. But in order to do so, we need to reach a consensus as to what it means and articulate what it means and why it matters to the wider public, and renew efforts to make it as accessible as possible to everyone. Thank you.